Hello and welcome to Legally Bond, a podcast presented by the law firm Bond, Chenick & King. I'm your host, Kim Wolf Price. On today's episode, we'll be talking with Lou Orbach. Lou is a member who sits in Bond's Syracuse office and practices civil litigation. He also chairs the firm's pro bono committee. Welcome to the podcast, Lou.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
I'm excited to have you on the podcast. It's nice when I get to have a floor neighbor join us on the podcast. So I'd like to spend some time today talking about your litigation practice here at Bond generally, but then focus on trademark litigation. And of course, I'd love to speak to you a little bit about your role as chair of the pro bono committee and why that work is also important to our profession. Does that sound like a plan?
That sounds great.
All right, great. So before we get into talking about litigation and practice and pro bono, sort of a tradition on how I start the podcast, I ask the guests to talk a little bit about themselves and their background, so the listeners know who's speaking. So would you mind taking a few minutes talking about maybe where you went to law school, undergrad, your background?
Sure. Well, I was born and raised in Chicago, right in the city, just a few L stops from Wrigley Field on the north side.
Nice.
And so it was a short hop down to the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, where I spent my undergrad years. And then I went to law school at the University of Michigan.
Very good. So a lot of time out in the Midwest.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. All right. So then what was your road to Bond? How did you get from Ann Arbor to Syracuse, New York? Where did you work before you joined the firm?
Oh, before I joined the firm, the first firm I worked at was Kirkland & Ellis in their Washington, D.C. office. And my wife and I decided to move up to upstate New York, where she was originally from. And I interviewed with Bond in 1994 and began with the firm in that year. And I've been here ever since.
I think that speaks volumes about the firm, right? Like, I mean, you're even a transplant to the area, but then now this is home.
Yeah, absolutely. And it has been a great fit for all these many years.
That's fantastic. Well, I really appreciate you sharing that background. I think getting to know the guests is important for the listeners. So I really appreciate it. All right. So litigation. We sit on the litigation floor here in the Chase Building in Syracuse, New York. When people think of it, they think of courtrooms and criminal trials and phrases like beyond a reasonable doubt. But civil litigation is different, isn't it? We often talk about the papers. Will you give an overview of business and civil litigation?
Sure. You were right. It's not all trial practice. A lot of paper is involved, or at least a lot of paper used to be involved.
That's true.
When I started out practicing in litigation, there would be a lot of time spent in storage rooms going through boxes and boxes of documents. Most of that now is done, as you know, online. But a lot of time is spent in discovery and depositions, taking testimony of witnesses outside of the courtroom, and then a lot of time in motion practice before discovery begins, after discovery ends, before trial, that sort of thing. And then appeals as well. We here at Bond do a lot of appellate work, both in the state courts and in the federal court system as well.
And that discovery process, for those who might not be lawyers, that's building the case, right? That's finding the facts, figuring out what really happened here.
That's right. Going through the documents, finding the information from the other side, talking to the witnesses, as I said, deposing the witnesses when necessary, just to try to build the case and find out what happened, as you say.
Yeah. All right. So what types of matters do you work on for clients?
I work on all variety of types of matters. I do a good deal of class action work, and I currently co-chair the firm's class action practice group. I do a lot of ERISA litigation and a lot of just basic commercial contract litigation. But what I spend much of my time on these days is trademark litigation. I think we're going to be talking a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think that's great. Yeah, thank you. I mean, what I love about litigation is that it can be so broad. You could be dealing with so many different sectors of the economy, you know, clients who do a wide variety of things. But when it comes to here's this problem, this dispute, help us fix it, then they come to the litigators.
Absolutely. Yes.
So do you primarily work in federal court or is it state court as well?
I work in both systems. A lot of my work is in federal court, especially the trademark and other intellectual property work, as well as most of the employee benefits work is in federal court. But the general commercial litigation, contract disputes, and that sort of thing, it can be 50-50 state court or federal court, depending on who the parties are.
That's right. So if you wouldn't mind, would you give a brief explanation? Because we talk about state and federal court, and that's just normal to us. But maybe explain that there's difference of jurisdiction. Things can happen in different places. Like you mentioned, trademark would be federal court typically. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, so the state courts have general jurisdiction over all sorts of claims, any kind of civil dispute that parties may have. The federal court's jurisdiction is more limited. To have a case brought in federal court, you need either federal question jurisdiction or diversity jurisdiction. And generally speaking, federal question jurisdiction is the type of jurisdiction you have where the claim is brought under a federal law, such as the Federal Trademark Act, which is known as the Lanham Act. Diversity jurisdiction is another way that you can have a case brought in federal court. And that's when, generally speaking, the parties are citizens of different states. They're located in different states. And the dollar value of the dispute is sufficient that it justifies bringing the case in federal court. Disputes that don't fit into one of those jurisdictional buckets, if you will, can always be brought in state court.
Right. And then they can be moved from one to the other upon motion of the parties. And then the court thinks that's correct, right? If someone says, well, actually, you don't have diversity jurisdiction in this matter, let's bring it back to state court. And that's part of what you have to do sometimes as well, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. If a party is sued in state court and they believe that the federal court has jurisdiction and that that is the most appropriate form in which to hear the case, then you can go through a process called removal, which is exactly what it sounds like. You can remove the case from state court to federal court. And then if the other side disagrees and believes that it's not properly in federal court, then they can make a motion to what we call remand the case to state court. And if the federal court decides that, yes, it doesn't really have jurisdiction over the case, then it can remand the case back to state court.
And usually the plaintiffs are pretty set on the court they filed in the first place. So I imagine it is a bit of a back and forth.
Yes. Yeah. Parties do appreciate having the case heard in the venue they've chosen, but it has to be the right venue.
That's right. And of course, that's not even all of it. There's also arbitration and mediation, aren't there?
That's right. And we see more and more of that. In terms of arbitration, of course, that's a situation where the parties agree that an arbitrator, an individual who's not a judge, will decide their matter in a forum outside of court. And that decision by the arbitrator will generally be binding on both parties. Now, both parties have to agree to have their case arbitrated, but we're seeing more and more of that in all sorts of contexts, because arbitration can, in many situations, be a more cost-effective way for the parties to resolve their disputes in less time than it would take to have the dispute resolved in court. Mediation is where a party, again, not the judge in a case, tries to help the parties reach an informal resolution of their dispute through a settlement. And the mediator generally doesn't have the power to issue a ruling in the case, but is just there as a facilitator to help the parties try to settle. And more situations, federal courts and also courts in the state system, especially in New York, will direct the parties to go to mediation at some point in the litigation process to see if that will help the parties settle before trial.
And because this is business litigation we're talking about, those other options are sometimes business decisions. You said it can save money. Maybe it saves a little time, whatever it may be. There's a lot that goes into making those decisions.
Yes, absolutely.
So I said in the introduction, we would talk a bit about your trademark litigation practice. Do you think maybe we should start with that basic question? What is a trademark?
Sure. A trademark is generally a word or a symbol, think of a logo, that represents a brand for a party or a particular product. And it really is an indicator of source of the goods or the service.
And so that must have incredible value to a business.
It does have incredible value to a business. Part of the fun of working in the trademark area is that when you're handling a case about a trademark, you're very often talking about the heart and the soul of a company. Trademarks can represent a company's history. They can represent the relationship that a company has with its customers and its clients. It can represent a company's aspirations. There's so much in a company's trademark, and that's why they're so important to protect.
Absolutely. And I'm sure in some ways, especially if it started as a family business or something like that, it's even a bit personal to the people involved.
Sure. But again, it's that symbol of the business. It's that symbol of the source of the goods and the relationship that the company has with the public and consumers.
Yeah, because it brings up a feeling in us when we see some of these trademarks.
Absolutely.
Have a response. So, all right, I should ask this then, I guess. What is trademark infringement? And is that where you come in?
That is where I come in as a litigator. And trademark infringement can take a variety of forms. The most common types of trademark violations, if you will, are what we call infringement itself, but there's also dilution. The test for infringement, most generally stated, is whether there's a likelihood of confusion caused by another party using a mark that is the same or similar to your client's mark.
So you said a couple of things in there that maybe we need to learn a little bit more about. Likelihood of confusion. And do you want to speak a little bit about that, explain a little bit?
Sure. The key to a claim for trademark infringement is whether there's a likelihood of confusion. And within the concept of confusion, there are a number of things to consider. So we're talking about a likelihood of confusion as to the source or the sponsorship or the approval of goods. So if you're using a mark on your goods that is confusingly similar to my trademark, will that cause consumers or potential consumers to mistakenly believe that your goods are either coming from my company or are sponsored or approved or somehow affiliated with my company? And that can happen in any number of ways. The law recognizes that confusion can happen at different points in the process of marketing and selling a good. It can happen at the point of sale, but it can also happen before sale. And courts recognize the concept of initial interest confusion. It can also happen after sale, and courts recognize the concept of post-sale confusion. There's also the direction of the confusion. Most generally, cases concern forward confusion, where the trademark holder, the plaintiff, if you will, which the cases call often the senior user, where the senior user is complaining that the defendant or the junior user is causing likelihood of confusion such that consumers or potential consumers may believe that the junior user's products are emanating from or are affiliated, sponsored, or approved by the senior user. But courts also recognize reverse confusion, where there is the possibility that the confusion goes in the other direction, that consumers may mistakenly believe that the plaintiff's products, the senior user's products, are coming from or are approved, affiliated, or sponsored by the junior user. And that will often occur where a larger company infringes on a smaller company's trademark.
That makes sense, right? Because people in the market know the larger company better, and that's where it becomes the opposite.
Sure.
So what do you enjoy about trademark litigation?
Well, a couple of things. First, as I mentioned before, when you're dealing with a trademark, you're often dealing with the heart and soul of a company. Trademark infringement and dilution are always very important issues to the client. And so, you know, if you're working on a trademark case, you're working on a very important case for the client. The other thing that I really enjoy about trademark litigation and other intellectual property litigation is you're almost always, by definition, working with creative people. Whether they are marketing people or inventors, you're working with creative people. And that's always a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that they have really spent a lot of time creating, marketing, supporting, improving, and all of those things.
Absolutely.
So is it usually the client, the trademark holder, who uncovers the infringing mark? Or can it come up in a variety of ways?
It can come up in a variety of ways. In the vast majority of cases, a client will come to us and let us know that they've discovered an infringement of their trademark out in the marketplace. But the more you work with a client, the more I work with trademark holders, I begin to look for their trademark when I'm out and about in the marketplace shopping or just traveling along. Yeah. And in fact, there was one instance when I was driving on the thruway.
Really?
And I saw a mark infringing the trademark of one of my clients plastered on the side of a tractor trailer on the thruway. And it was parked on the thruway. And when I got to the office, let the client know, and we took it from there. And that was kind of fun. But most often it is the client who will discover the infringement and come to us.
It's not necessarily the lawyer every time that finds
no.
it.
No.
That's a great story, though. You know, it's a little bit of an occupational hazard, right? You can't stop thinking about
Absolutely.
Those things.
That's right. That's right.
So, I mean, I think you've talked about this a little bit, but just to sort of drive it home for anyone who might be listening, why is it important for trademark holders to take this seriously, to pay attention to their marks and protect them?
It's so important because it is a symbol of the source of the goods. And so it is part of the relationship that you have with your customers and your clients. And so as a business matter, it's important to protect those trademarks. As a legal matter, it's important to protect the trademarks because if you let your trademarks go unprotected and there becomes a number of uses of your mark or confusingly similar marks or dilutive marks out in the marketplace, you could actually lose your trademark rights through a variety of means and mechanisms under the law. So it's important to protect those trademarks, both from a business perspective and a legal perspective.
So it's active. So you have to keep on top of it.
Absolutely. It's a necessary investment in the trademark.
Or hire an attorney who drives around and looks.
No promises that I will continue to find evidence on the thruway. Yes.
But I love that story. Well, before you go, you chair the firm's pro bono committee. And just, I think most people know, but pro bono work is where attorneys assist individuals who could not otherwise afford legal representation. And sometimes the not-for-profit organizations aimed at helping those individuals or groups. So why is pro bono work important?
Pro bono work is vitally important because it's just a fundamental pillar of our system of law that everyone deserves representation, whether they can afford a lawyer or not. And it's important for lawyers to give back to society in the way that we've been trained and educated to do. It's an obligation that we all should feel we have. And it's certainly one that the bar associations in all of the jurisdictions where we practice encourage.
That's so true. That's true. And it's a privilege we have the law license, right?
You're absolutely right.
Share that. So, and for the firm, we're a business, but why and how does the firm support pro bono work?
So the firm supports pro bono work in a number of ways. First, by providing the opportunities and the resources for our attorneys to perform a variety of pro bono work. And then by crediting our attorneys for the hours they spend on pro bono when it comes to the end of the year and review time, that work is credited under the firm's pro bono policy, as you know, as our firm's pro bono coordinator. And so it's very much encouraged here and it's very much supported.
And I think by doing that, it shows the firm's commitment by saying those hours will count for your goals for the year.
Yes, I think that's right.
And what do you want to give a little bit of an overview of some of the types of pro bono matters we handle, often with volunteer legal services agencies across our many jurisdictions?
Yes, there are a number of types of pro bono activities that we engage in several jurisdictions across New York State. We will represent individual tenants in landlord-tenant court where the tenant can't afford an attorney. And we usually do that, as you say, through volunteer lawyer project programs. And we also do counseling of veterans and we do pro bono immigration work. And we also do non-litigation and non-administrative work in terms of counseling small businesses on startups and even on intellectual property matters where that is appropriate pro bono work.
And that's so important because those are probably lawyers that individuals wouldn't just run into, right? Folks who understand trademark or understand some of these pieces or some of the business aspects as well.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
So it's a great way for the firm to give back.
It is.
All right. Well, thank you, Luke, for joining us on the podcast today. It's always great to have the chance to speak with you. And I really did enjoy learning more about the trademark work. And see, every time I hear a story that I have not heard from someone. So I love, this is like the podcast, my side gig that I enjoy. So I hope you'll come back and join us again for another topic.
I'd love to. This was great. A lot of fun.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Legally Bond. If you're listening and have any questions for me, want to hear from someone at the firm, or have a suggestion for a future topic, please email us at legallybond@bsk.com. Also, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Legally Bond wherever podcasts are downloaded. Until our next talk, be well.
Bond, Shenick, and King has prepared this communication to present only general information. This is not intended as legal advice, nor should you consider it as such. You should not act or decline to act based upon the contents. While we try to make sure that the information is complete and accurate, laws can change quickly. You should always formally engage a lawyer of your choosing before taking actions which have legal consequences. For information about our communication, firm, practice areas, and attorneys, visit our website, bsk.com. This is attorney advertising.